Interruptions can be infuriating. Now, sometimes we can handle interruptions, like when we're not on a tight schedule or when there's nothing urgent going on. But that's not when interruptions happen, is it? They always come at the worst possible times, when we're busy, when we're already running late, when there's so much on our schedule and our agenda. Maybe interruptions happen all the time, but those are the times that they really seem to get under our skin. They really irritate us. And beyond that, it's not just the interruptions themselves. They can spark other problems, like resentment. We can adopt an attitude of, why me, Lord? Why now? Or we can resent those individuals that interrupt our lives. I mean, don't you realize I have important things to do? Don't you realize that I have a schedule? We can get irritable, and it can rub off on those around us. But here's the truth of the matter. And if there's a bottom line to this message, this is it. People are more important than things, including our schedule, our agenda, and those urgent things that we think need our attention at that moment. You see this in the life of Jesus. He worked hard. He had very, very busy days. And yet, he always made time for people. There are times in his life where he is on his way from one place to another to do something, maybe very urgent, and he will stop what he's doing in order to minister to one person, because that one is important. 55 years ago, Charles Hummel published a little booklet. It's called Tyranny of the Urgent. It was hailed not only in Christian circles, but even in business circles for its innovative approach to time management. But it was really about priorities. The author related how once an experienced factory manager said to him, "Your greatest danger is letting the urgent things crowd out the important." Did you catch that? Your greatest danger is allowing the urgent things to crowd out the important. He went on to write, "We live in constant tension between the urgent and the important. The problem is that many of our important tasks may not need to be done today. They're easily put off to another day, spending time in prayer and Bible study, a visit to an elderly friend, reading an important book. They can usually wait. But when urgent things come, what I would classify as interruptions, that captures our attention. And though they might be less important, they can occupy our time and keep us from what's truly important." I imagine we all know what that pressure is like. The demands that we feel, whether they're put on us by others or maybe we just feel them ourselves. We have to get this done, and someone or something, and usually it is a someone, interrupts, throws us off of our well-planned schedule. This morning, I'd like to consider how Jesus dealt with this tension between the urgent and the important without losing sight of his mission. I believe we can learn from these one-on-one interactions Jesus had with individuals as we consider Jesus and the interrupting. In Luke chapter 8, verse 40 sets the stage. "Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him." Here we see the expectant crowd. Now it says that when Jesus returned, you might say, returned from what? Well, remember in our last study, Jesus was in Capernaum in that area, told his disciples, we need a break, we need to get away, let's go across the Sea of Galilee to the other side. So they get in the boat, they go across. On their way across, they meet a violent storm. That's got everybody's nerves on edge. When they land in the region of the Gerasenes, which is a Gentile district. They encounter a man who's possessed by a number of demons, living in a cemetery, screaming and yelling and cutting himself and breaking chains they tried to bind him with. This guy's a total mess. Jesus casts out the demons. They go into a herd of pigs that run down the hillside into the lake and are drowned. When the people of the area come by and see what's happened, they say, wow, Jesus, that's really nice, but we'd like you to leave. So Jesus and his disciples get back in the boat, cross back over to Capernaum. That's what Luke is talking about. Their little getaway for rest and relaxation was anything but. And when Jesus and the disciples return, there is the crowd, that ever-present crowd. And it says they were expecting him. What do you think they were expecting? More miracles, more teaching, more interaction. Maybe some of them wanted to be entertained. You get that impression in the Gospels. Full of expectations. How could Jesus meet all of their expectations? But they're there. I'm sure the disciples are thinking, oh, great, another crowd. Full of expectations. What's going to happen now? Whatever those expectations were, though, they were about to get trumped by an individual and then another. Verses 41 and 42 record the emerging crisis. Then a man named Jairus, a ruler of the synagogue, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. One man fights his way through the crowd in order to get to Jesus. Now, most of the townsfolk would have recognized him, and seeing the desperate look on his face made way for him. Luke introduces him as Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue. In our terminology, we would say he was probably an elder or a deacon in the local church. The ruler of the synagogue in those days would line up those who would lead in prayer, those who would read from the scriptures, those who would preach. So he was a well-known, highly respected man of the community. But Jairus did not come as a distinguished figure. He came as a desperate father, frantic to find help for his 12-year-old daughter. No doubt by this time, Jairus and his wife had tried everything they could think of. They called everybody in the book. No one was answering their 911 calls. The little girl was getting worse, and it looked like she could die at any moment. And so he swallows his pride and comes to this rabbi. People have been talking about. There's rumors of miracles and healings and other things, and maybe out of a desperate last-ditch effort, he comes to Jesus. And you'll notice that in the story, the crowd seems to fade into the background. Oh, they're still there. They're still there pressing in around Jesus. But when that one person comes, Jesus zooms in his attention to that individual. At that moment, the rest of the crowd fades into the distance. That one is important. And Jesus gives him his attention. Now, I'm sure Jairus was elated when he made his request and Jesus said, yes, I'll go. And they begin to make their way to Jairus' house. The end of verse 42 says, as Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. Imagine this mass of people surrounding Jesus and his disciples. Jairus is trying to lead the way to his house, and they're all following. They're all pressing in. They all want to know what's going to happen next. But like an ambulance stuck in a traffic jam, I imagine Jairus' frustration level was getting a little high. He's probably thinking, if he's not saying out loud, come on, people, clear a path. My daughter's life is on the line. And suddenly the procession stops. Now my guess is Jairus didn't. I'm thinking he probably took several steps before he realized nobody else was moving. He turns around and there's Jesus. Jesus had stopped in the middle of the street and he's looking around. And he's asking what must have sounded like the most asinine question ever asked. Who touched me? Are you kidding? Come on, Jesus. Who didn't touch you? This crowd is pressing in around you, crowding in. Everybody's touching you. What do you mean? And Jesus says, no. Someone touched me because I could feel the power leave. Now, we know the story. We've heard it. We know what happens next. But try to put yourself in Jairus' sandals at this point. Come on. I have an urgent need. My daughter is dying. I need you to come right now. And Jesus stops. Why? Because there's another individual that warrants his attention. I'm not at all suggesting that Jairus and his need, his daughter, were unimportant to Jesus. They weren't. But he was not going to ignore an important need of another individual in order to meet the one. Again, we see Jesus' priority. And what we see here is what I'm calling the enlightening compassion. We see a lot about Jesus in this moment. Yes, he is on his way on a very urgent mission, but he never loses sight of the importance of one. And this one person reaches out and touches him. As it turns out, she's every bit as desperate as Jairus. There's even something else interesting that they have in common. She has had this condition where she has been bleeding for 12 years, the exact age of Jairus' daughter. Is it a coincidence? I don't know. I don't really believe in coincidences. I think it's one way of showing that her need, though different, was every bit as important as what Jairus was facing. And he stops, and he says, who touched me? And his disciples are like, are you kidding me? How are we supposed to figure out who touched you? We don't have, you know, CSI coming in with the fingerprint dust, you know, and all that stuff. But Jesus knew that his power had gone from him. And I don't think Jesus is asking because he doesn't know. He knows who touched him. He knows the whole story. I think this is a lot like the Garden of Eden after Adam and Eve sinned. God comes to walk with them in the cool of the evening and they're hiding behind trees. And God says, Adam, where are you? Do you really think he didn't know where Adam was? He knew exactly where Adam was. He wanted Adam to admit it. And that's exactly what Jesus is doing here. I'm sure this woman thought, if I can just touch his garment, I'll be healed, and then I can slip away. No one will ever have to know. You say, why would she want to do that? Understand that in those days, when a woman was bleeding, whether it was your regular monthly period, or in this case, something extending beyond that, she was ritually unclean. She could not go to the synagogue or the temple to worship. She could not even get out into the community because anything or anyone she touched would then become unclean. So as she's jostling through the crowd to get to Jesus, she's contaminating everybody she touches. There was no social distancing in this crowd, and I doubt anybody was wearing a mask. Can you imagine what those people would have felt if they had known, hey, this woman's been touching me and now I'm unclean. Now I got to go through all this rigmarole in order to get clean again. They might have been really upset with her. So I'm sure she just wanted to, you know, touch and run. I'm out of here. Nobody knows the difference. But that wasn't good enough for Jesus. Why? For one thing, her faith needed a little instruction. Notice that she says, if I just touch his garment, I'll be healed. There's a little superstition there, isn't there? You know? Kind of like those TV preachers that say, you know, you send me money and I'll send you this Kleenex I blew my nose in and, you know, you'll get rich and healthy and all that stuff. You almost get an inkling of that here, right? You know, if I just touch his garment, you say, yeah, but it worked, so it must have been okay. That's not what worked. This is not superstition any more than Jesus casting the demons out of the man in the last chapter was magic. And Jesus wanted this woman to know exactly what had happened because it was going to change her life. And so, the woman, seeing she could not go unnoticed, isn't that amazing? She wanted to go unnoticed, and Jesus wasn't going to let her. That's how important she was to him. He was not going to let her go by unnoticed. So she comes, and she says she comes trembling, fell at his feet. I'm sure she was afraid that she was in trouble, if not with him, with the crowd. But she explains what she did and why. And I want you to notice what Jesus said to her. Verse 48, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. This is the only reference in all of the Gospels that Jesus ever refers to a woman like this. Daughter, you matter. He could have said to her, I created you. I know you. I care about you. You matter to me. You're not just some nameless face in the crowd. You matter. And then he says, your faith has healed you. The Greek word there for healed is actually the word sozo, which means save. Your faith has saved you. You say, well, is that just physical healing or spiritual salvation? And the answer is yes. I believe it was both. But he wanted to make sure that she realized that this wasn't just some sleight of hand magic trick. This wasn't some superstition that happened to come true. Your faith is what not only heals your body, but saves your soul. And yes, it was important enough to Jesus for her to know that he stopped what he was doing to give the attention to her. All right, great. Jairus is probably off to the side, tapping his foot, saying, come on, Jesus, let's go, let's go. You know, good, that's good. She's healed. Let's go. And then somebody from his house comes and says, it's too late. In verse 49, while Jesus is still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. Your daughter is dead, he said. Don't bother the teacher anymore. Again, try to put yourself in Jairus' sandals that day. What do you think is going through his mind now? As flabbergasted as the disciples were that Jesus would say, "Who touched me?" Jairus is saying, "Why? Why did you stop here? Okay, that woman, she's important, you know, and she's been suffering 12 years. I get that. But, you know, she wasn't going to die of this. You could have come back for her, or you could have just let her go into the crowd. You know, she could touch your garment and just keep moving. Why didn't you come to my house? My daughter is dead. Am I that unimportant to you, Jesus? Is my little girl matter that little that you couldn't come and heal her?" Let's get real. Haven't we all said that at one time in our lives? We've begged Jesus to intervene. And maybe it was for physical healing, or maybe it was for a relationship to be healed, or maybe it was for a business to survive, or whatever it might have been, something very important to us. And it seems like God doesn't care. Like the disciples in the boat and in the storm, "Jesus, don't you care that we're going to drown?" I'm sure Jesus is saying, "You're still talking, so you haven't drowned yet." But those feelings are there. We feel like our need is the most important, and yet God seems to be doing something else. And you even catch a bit of the lack of faith in the servant. "Don't bother the teacher anymore. Your daughter's dead. We can't do anything more for her. Sickness is one thing, death's another." We have a phrase in the fire service: "You can't fix dead." And that's the idea here. It's over. No more hope. No more chance. And now you have Jairus is standing there. The crowd, I'm sure, is hushed. And Jesus turns to him and says, "Don't be afraid. Just believe, and your daughter will be..." Now, your Bible says healed, but it's the same verb as in the previous verse, saved. "Keep your faith. I haven't forgotten about you, Jairus, or your daughter. But you just saw the faith of this woman. She knew that if she just touched my garment, she'd be healed, and she was. You have that kind of faith, and your need will be met as well." We're not told what Jairus said, but we are told that Jairus continued to lead Jesus to the house and went in with him. He exercised faith. He went in with his wife, with Jesus, with Peter, James, and John. Verse 51 says, "When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go with him except the child's father and mother, Peter, James, and John. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her." "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She's not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. And by the way, she was dead. Luke makes that very clear. Remember, Luke was a physician in his day. He knows what dead is. But Jesus said, "This case is not permanent." He took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. Now, we've seen this on other occasions. Jesus says, you know, don't tell anyone. It's kind of hard to keep something like this quiet, right? I mean, he just raised a little girl from the dead. There's a huge crowd of people, and everybody there knew Jairus. It's going to be impossible to keep this from getting out. So what's his point? I think what Jesus is doing here is telling the parents, I want you to focus more on your daughter than in all the publicity. Don't get caught up with giving interviews, you know. Tell Lester Holt he'll have to wait. Take care of your daughter. Notice he says, give her something to eat. She had been sick for a while. She probably hadn't eaten. She'd be very hungry. Focus on your daughter, not the crowd. Just as he could zoom in on the individual, he's telling the parents to do the same thing. You take care of your daughter. Don't worry about anything else. Again, the individual is important. So what do we learn from this event in the life of Jesus? How do we handle the interruptions in our lives? I believe it's all a matter of perspective. Because it's so easy to view interruptions as distractions from real life when we're in a hurry. If we live on such a tightly scheduled life that we have no time for interruptions, we're missing some of God's best opportunities. Now, some, you know, interruptions are unavoidable. We hate to admit it, but they're going to happen. They always do. Maybe it's wise to build into our schedules some extra room for interruptions. I had a Bible college professor who was a minister teaching a course on ministry, and I remember him saying, you need to schedule every day for interruptions. And I'm thinking to myself, how do you do that? By very nature, you don't know when they're going to happen. His point was, don't schedule your day so full that you can't be interrupted. Because those interruptions may be the most important thing God has for you to do that day. And almost every time, interruptions have a face and a name. They're people. And people are more important than things. People are more important than that project I'm trying to get done, or that sermon that I'm trying to write, or this schedule that I'm trying to keep. So make room for God to step into our day and say, I have something for you to do. Jesus was on his way to an urgent mission to heal a little girl, to bring her from the brink of death. And I'm sure at that moment he was laser focused on Jairus and his daughter. But an interruption came. Someone else with a very important need came, and Jesus stopped for her. Now the temptation for us is when an interruption comes, we're like, well, if I take the time to do this, I won't get this other stuff done. But it's amazing that when we take the time to do what God wants us to do, He enables us to get the other stuff done as well. Jesus still healed that little girl, even though it took a little longer than some would have liked. And He touched not the life of one, but of two, because they were important to Him. He always made time for people that others would overlook, people that others might cast to the side and say, you know, you're not important. Jesus knew that they were. How unlike many pastors and other Christian leaders. I mean, we're programmed to be highly organized. Not all of us get there, but you know, we try to be. We've got our schedules, we have our agendas, we've got things that, you know, are so important that sometimes the flock becomes a distant second. We need to be reminded that people are never an interruption in our ministry. They are the ministry. If you're too busy to meet the needs of a hurting congregation when they're in need, then you're too busy to be a pastor. Our Lord was never that busy. And the servant is not greater than his Lord, nor is his schedule more important than ours. I'm convinced that when public ministry is over, it's those private times of ministry that are going to live on. People don't remember sermons. I know that because every now and then I'll preach a sermon that I preached some time ago and people say, I've never heard anything like that before. And I want to say, oh, yes, you have. People don't remember this. They don't remember the ceremonies. What they remember is the time you took to pray, the time you took to listen. And that's not only true for pastors, it's true for every one of us. There's an old saying, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Making time for people, listening, reaching out to them, that's showing how much you care. And that means a great deal to God, as it does that individual. Who needs some of your love and your time today? You see, even when Jesus was constantly surrounded by expectant crowds and urgent needs, he lived life with a zoom lens. When someone stood in front of Jesus, time stopped. Everything else in his life, his concerns, his agenda, his goals, they just kind of blurred and faded into the background. He was always fully present because he knew that one at a time was the way he was going to change the world. The importance comes before the urgent, and nothing is more important than people. That was Jesus' agenda, and I would suggest it needs to be ours.